Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. On today's show, Lauren Euler. On her new collection of essays, No Judgment, on being critical. Lauren Euler is the author of the novel Fake Accounts. Her essays on books and culture appear regularly in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The London Review of Books, Harper's, The Guardian, and other publications. And today we're going to be talking about No Judgment, on being critical. Lauren, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all then, tell us, I guess, how you would describe this collection. Does it have a sort of overarching theme?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I will say it's not a natural state of mind to be writing six long critical essays in a row, which I learned after I embarked on the project. There's a reason why most essay collections are collected from more or less previously published works. But I had a couple of ideas for essays that I wanted to write that for various reasons I didn't want to write. The traditional way to publish an essay is you write it for a magazine, and then over time you develop an august oeuvre, and then you collect them all and you write a little introduction. But for various reasons, I didn't want to write these essays for magazines, mostly because I wanted to be free to sort of expand and digress and basically make them really long and kind of strange. So I had the idea for a few of them, and then I came up with a couple of other ideas for essays, and I thought, oh, all of these fit together really nicely. And now I'll spend the next 2 years figuring out how that is. And, you know, I think in general, I'm a book critic myself. And in general, when I review other authors' work, I try and see the threads throughout all of their work, right? So even if you try to write about something completely different from what you usually write about, almost every author tends to write about the same things, their preoccupations. And that's actually why it's so interesting to write about authors' entire works over their lifetime, because you see what their preoccupations are, even if they might not have seen that, at least at the start. So I tried not to worry too much about making the essays cohere, because I trusted that my neurotic brain would pick up on the same little things over and over. But because I'm a critic, of course, one of the preoccupations there is criticism and how it functions today in a very sort of mediatized, hyper-globalized society where everything is sort of instantaneously happening all the time. And everybody, also one of the things I think is interesting about this moment in criticism is that so many people have this sort of meta awareness of how the media works and how criticism works. And so that naturally affects the way that they engage with social media, but also, I would argue, with books and with films and other sort of more traditional forms of media. So I think that that kind of development or tension is present throughout the essays, but there are also sort of funnier themes as well. As I write in the introduction, one of the things I noticed when I was editing all the essays together and trying to figure out, you know, what order should they go in, is that I keep talking about revenge because I have a sort of chip on my shoulder about a personal issue that we don't need to go into. But, you know, I kept thinking about revenge as I was writing them. So it just appears so many times. And that, of course, wasn't planned. Whereas maybe a sort of, intellectual focus on criticism was obviously intended by me. Revenge was not.
So the first essay in the collection is about gossip. So before we actually sort of get into the meat of it, what's your own, and indeed you do talk about this in the essay, what is your own personal relationship and feelings about gossip?
Oh, I can't get enough of it. I think, I wonder if it's a problem. So I say in the essay, I have all these sort of guardrails and elaborate guidelines in place to make sure that I don't overstep any boundaries that are sort of made up by me that allow me to still gossip to the extent that I want to. And, you know, I'm always afraid that, I talk about this in the essay too, I'm always sort of anxious that I'm going to get in trouble for gossiping, or anxious that people will sort of identify me as a horrible gossip and just stop telling me things. But so far it hasn't happened. But, you know, I think I was thinking about gossip because I noticed in the last several years, a lot of writers trying to rehabilitate the concept or re-rehabilitate the concept. The concept of the idea of gossip as a sort of feminist practice, the way that sort of marginalized populations share information with each other, was very popular in the 70s and 80s and in feminist writing in the 70s and 80s. And it became popular again in the last 5-6 years during the Me Too movement and various other sort of mainstream feminist movements. So you read a lot about gossip as a kind of media technology. And so I was thinking about this, and I always felt that that was sort of, you know, I thought it was just too simple to say, of course, gossip is actually good, or gossip is bad, as we used to say. So I wanted to sort of tease out how gossip functions in the media now. And so that led me to think about not just feminist media, but all commentary and all sort of news reporting and how that's changed in the last 10, 15 years, and try to understand the very dramatic ways that the media has changed since the sort of rise of the social internet through the lens of gossip. And this, basically, you could argue, if you wanted to criticize me, you could argue that all of this media theory was just a way for me to justify my own gossip addiction. But hopefully I've added a little bit more nuance to the conversation and not just made it about who's sleeping with whom.
I mean, you mentioned sort of, you know, 70s feminist theories bring in gossip, because obviously gossip is something that, you know, I mean, we have no sort of like idea whether this is real or not, but people always assume it's something that like women do more than men. And so therefore being feminized, it's one of the ways in which it's seen as like a bad thing. But researchers have posited as well, and you sort of touch on this in the book, that like gossip might have been something like a sort of almost evolutionary theory of gossip, that it might have been something that helped early societies cohere together as groups.
Absolutely. It helps people sort of understand, you know, the hierarchy of a social group and maintain that social hierarchy, right? It also helps people sort of understand where they stand in the social hierarchy and how to avoid trouble. How to survive in a social group, whether that is, you know, cavemen or the New York City media, right? Like you can't just rely on your own information in any scenario. You need to sort of pool information in order to more fully understand your surroundings and your context. So of course, it's sort of reductive and kind of pointless to say, well, gossip is bad, gossip's immoral, you shouldn't do it. Somebody who says that is probably near the top of a hierarchy and is engaging in gossip actually all the time, because there's no way that you can sort of be powerful without the sharing of information, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned obviously like the sort of rise of social media. You talk in the book about the before the rise of social media, the rise of Gawker and its associated sites, and the sort of effect that had on news media. But then obviously, you know, with the sort of rise of Trump and ideas of like fake news, in a lot of respects, news itself, like to what extent is like news and gossip actually different anymore?
Right, exactly. And I'm, you know, Gawker was really interesting in the sort of genealogy of this idea for me, because it exists at the center of tabloid media, so gossip magazines, and like actual news reporting. And it was very uncomfortably situated in the middle of those things, because on one hand, when it started out, it wanted to be known as this bombastic, truth-telling, but very gossipy, very celebrity-oriented in many ways, website, where you, their tagline was "Today's gossip is tomorrow's news." So they're doing a lot of media reporting, but they're also doing a lot of sort of celebrity sightings and kind of changing the way that celebrity gossip was reported in many ways, in part because they allowed their readers to comment and to send tips and were very sort of open about their relationship with their audience, which obviously traditional gossip magazines couldn't really be, even if they had sort of letters to the editor or whatever. So that concept sort of arose in tandem with social media, and you can see exactly what the relationship between those two sort of policies was, right? In the meantime, you have in traditional media is for the last 15, 20 years, have been said to be threatened by the internet, threatened by social media, constantly trying to adapt to these new conditions and doing so in various ways. And I think there's sort of a way in which the newsreader, the audience for traditional media, has also shaped the way that news is reported. And you can see how that is if you think about something like Gawker, where the audience was, you know, the audience was always right, right? Like they would comment, they would drive the way that Gawker was reporting the news because the traffic for the website was so important to Gawker, which I get into in the essay. So then traditional media, and I'm very careful to say that, you know, the New York Times isn't just a gossip rag, right? Like I'm not saying that all, you know, CNN is fake news, certainly not, but rather that the average media consumer now is incredibly distrustful of traditional media and of the news and reporting, such that they read the newspaper almost as if they are reading gossip, which is to say that they're reading something that they understand to be probably or partially true, but also biased and also sort of incomplete in its reporting, right? So there's just this total lack of trust in media, and there are many statistics that sort of prove this. And because of that, I argue basically that the average media consumer is, what's happening when they read the news or watch the news is quite similar to what happens when they hear a piece of gossip, right? Like they don't necessarily believe or disbelieve it. They may want to believe it, or they may want to reject it, which is exactly what happens when we hear a piece of gossip. And it's often very salacious and unbelievable, as the best gossip always is.
In the next essay in the book, which is about criticism itself, the first part of this takes a sort of deep dive into the bookish social media site Goodreads, and it seems, I guess, sort of crazy as this is a books podcast, but I guess for the tiny percentage of this audience that doesn't know what it is, can you explain to us what Goodreads is?
Absolutely. Goodreads is a platform for logging and sharing your reading with other Goodreads users. I believe the most recent statistic that I found is that it has 125 million users, but I could be wrong. And basically, it's an interesting social media website because it's specific, right? It's not a general site like Twitter or Facebook or TikTok. It's very specifically about books for readers. So this makes it seem sort of niche, even though it has a large user base, and it may or may not have a big effect on how books are published and marketed. And it's, if you've never heard of it, it's quite notorious because over the years, there have been many controversies that center on Goodreads and the users there, because the users are very active, even if there are fewer of them than, say, on Twitter or Facebook. The users are very active and they're very passionate about the kinds of books that they like to read. And so in my essay, I detail, you know, the relationship between Goodreads and publishing and Goodreads and Amazon. In 2013, Amazon bought Goodreads. It used to be a sort of independent website. And now it's owned by Amazon. So that's another element to its relevance in the discussion of books and publishing. But this, it's always in the news. You'll periodically, every 6 months or so, there's some kind of dramatic dust up on Goodreads where a mob has formed and they've decided that they're going to get an author's book canceled or collectively review bomb an author's work because they have said something politically incorrect or something like this. So what I wanted to investigate, as somebody who works in the publishing industry, sort of, I'm an author and also I'm a book critic, I wanted to understand if Goodreads actually had any power in the publishing industry, or if this was a sort of knee-jerk response to a very understandable fear of a social media mob ruining your career, right? Because everybody sort of talks about it as if it definitely has power. And I wasn't quite sure if that was the case. And this led me to research all sorts of things about Goodreads. One thing I did not mention, shockingly, is that it operates on a star system. So readers can rate books that they've read or not read, but they can still rate them on a scale from 0 to 5 stars. And, you know, usually readers hate this kind of thing because they think it lacks nuance and does a disservice to any book that's being published. This essay also does a history of the star rating system, which I found was quite fascinating and was very happy to spend some time learning about. It goes back to the late 18th century, in fact. so it's not this sort of algorithmic, commodified invention that, you know, Luddites and people who hate social media would say, you know, the star rating system is ruining literature. And I'm like, well, it's been ruining literature since 1792, more or less.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Lauren Euler, and we're talking about her essay collection, No Judgment, on being critical. And Lauren, I want to just stick with the star rating system for a bit longer. Just expand a bit more on what's up with it.
Sure. So basically, I see there is a kind of tension, an unresolvable tension between a star rating system for works of art and a sort of long qualitative assessment of the work of art, right? And many people would say that that is the case. But the star rating system, more or less, can be traced back to the rise of bourgeois travel in the early 1800s. So this English writer, Mariana Stark, traveled with her family to Italy because many of them had tuberculosis. And they spent many years traveling through the south of France and Italy. And while they were doing this, Mariana Stark found that she really wanted a resource that would help her, see the best sites in the south of France and Italy, given that she had limited time and her family, who were very sick, had limited mobility. So she took copious notes for all the years that she was traveling. And she came back and she pitched a book about, you know, all the best sites that she found, and also had tips for getting around hostels, assuming that the people that she was writing for wouldn't necessarily have time to hire a guide, time or money to hire a guide, and wouldn't necessarily have time to see everything. Now, before this, travel on the continent had primarily been the purview of aristocrats who would go on a grand tour, right? And so these generally young men would go on a grand tour of Europe for several years and sort of see everything and get cultured, right? And Mariana Stark was the beginning of a time when travel became more accessible. This was just before rail travel became more widely developed and allowed people to travel around. And also she was traveling right at the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars, which when they were over, allowed people to come from England to the continent and sort of see more. But the people who were traveling under these new conditions generally weren't traveling for many months or years. They had, you know, a couple of weeks or a month or so to see some stuff. And so what Mariana Stark did was come up with a guidebook, and she marked particularly interesting or important works of art and other sites with exclamation points. So the more exclamation points a sculpture or a cathedral or what have you had, the better it was in her eyes. And this was basically the beginning of the star rating system as we know it. And what was interesting to me is that the star rating system today still has this sort of populist understanding in its purpose, which is that, you know, we don't have the time to see a bad movie, right? We don't have 10 hours to spare on a book that we're not going to like. So we need to know, is this the best way that I could be spending my limited time for culture, right? So if it weren't my job to read a lot of books, right? And I want to have a book to read on my summer vacation, what am I going to do? I'm probably going to go on Amazon, or I'm going to go on Goodreads, and I'm going to see the star ratings of a book that my friend has recommended to me. And if it has a high star rating, many different people like it, and I can read their reviews a little bit and see why they like it, then I'm going to choose to read that book because the wisdom of the crowds, right? And what I found interesting is that it still functions that way, right? It's exactly the same way we use star ratings. I'm guilty of using the Google review star rating to find restaurants. And even if I feel like I interpret it with a bit more nuance than simply, 4.5 is better than 4.3, of course, I'm going to do a little bit more research, but it's still the same thing. You know, you only have so much time if you're traveling. You only have so much time to read for pleasure. You only have so much time to see a movie. So you're going to want to see the best thing possible with that limited amount of time. And what I found interesting is basically this hasn't changed at all, even as so much more media has become so much more accessible for people of all class backgrounds, with all sorts of amounts of time on their hands. Everybody is still sort of interacting with art and culture in this way. And I think that's kind of a shame because there's not always a great wisdom in the crowd, particularly when it has to do with something as individual and complicated as art or literature.
There's a lot of talk about how, you know, what's the point of critics nowadays? Because everybody can, you know, comment and write their own reviews on various websites. Therefore, everybody is a critic. But I think the issue seems more to be to me that, you know, because the internet has hollowed out so many industries, what do you see, Lauren, is the future of criticism like this book as a job?
Well, I think that there are a certain amount of people who will always see the value in sort of long, nuanced, but complex criticism that isn't about just bullet points, what's in this movie and should you see it or not, right? What's in the movie and is it good or not, right? And the purpose of the sort of traditional critical model, if I can say that there is such a thing, is that everyone is an individual. So if there are many professional critics writing for many different publications, you will probably get a lot of different views on the same books or films or whatever. And the best thing to do is read several of them, see who seems most like you or who you most agree with generally, and listen to them or not, right? Like, I think ideally what would happen is that everybody has a sort of self-actualized relationship to culture, and critics are just a sort of professional manifestation of that. Also, we do some nice research sometimes, and you can learn things from reading a piece of criticism, even if you've already seen the movie or read the book or seen the exhibition or whatever. The future, I think, is quite interesting. I've had lots of interesting conversations with this with regards to AI and ChatGPT, the specter haunting the publishing industry, which is to say that it is quite hard to imagine ChatGPT writing a review of something. Responding to a film or a book, even if it can get to a place where it can read, quote unquote, or watch a movie, it can't have an opinion, right? And the value of professional criticism is in, as Elizabeth Hardwick once wrote, the drama of opinion. And so I think if there is to be a future of criticism, professional critics have to accept and cherish the drama of opinion and not be afraid of it. And, you know, there's always talk about criticism is dying and all the reviews are fake because people just say what they think everyone wants to hear and the reviews are too nice and all this kind of stuff. And I basically, if I may speak a little bit like this is not a manifesto, but I'm sort of sounding like a manifesto. I think like the important thing is to remember like the human values that make criticism so fun to read and enriching to read. I don't know if that quite answers your question. What is the future of criticism? I don't like to predict. I like to have diagnosed things and then found them to be correct later.
That seems fair enough.
Yeah.
So finally then, I wanted to talk about your essay on autofiction for a little while. And at the beginning of this, you basically describe, if I can paraphrase, like fiction as being the best type of writing. So I want to talk to you first of all about what's the appeal of fiction to you?
Well, I intended that to be a little bit provocative because I find that writers of various forms and genres tend to get really attached to them and feel that the other genres are sort of picking on them or they're unfairly maligned in the face of one genre. So I thought, you know, I'll take a side immediately and say fiction is the best. But what I like about fiction is the sense of possibility that it allows both when you're writing it and when you're reading it. So I think that autofiction as a form, even if it seems like quite wilted and sort of hews closely to life, it might not actually. And I think that autofiction as a form demonstrates what is so valuable and important about fiction and why I personally like fiction more than anything. It's because autofiction insists that there is something to be gained from fictionality, even if it seems totally true, right? And what is to be gained from fictionality? All sorts of things. It basically allows you to say anything that happened or anything that didn't happen. And the only limit is not to sound like a kindergarten teacher, but your own imagination. And, you know, also from a pragmatic point of view, fiction writing allows you to avoid lots of pesky legal issues that and ethical issues that writing nonfiction and memoir often bring up. So, you know, there's the classic mode of talking about a novel, which is, you know, if let's say it's a scandalous novel about an affair or something, and you're like, ah, oh, this is based on Oscar Wilde, and this is based on whomever, or this is based on Mary McCarthy, and this is based on, I don't know, Elizabeth Hardwick. And it's quite fun to do this sort of sleuthing behind the fiction, find the real story behind the fiction, even if that isn't ultimately quite simplistic. An impoverished way to read books. And I wouldn't advocate that as the only way to read books, but I do love gossip. And I do think that there is, to get back to the first question you asked, I do think that there's a very strong relationship between gossip and autofiction and gossip as storytelling and fiction as storytelling as well.
If I can just invoke the ghost of Joyce Carol Oates, his famous tweet about it. what do you think? People do seem to have an issue with autofiction. And thinking back to something we talked about gossip, which is that gossip was something supposedly that women do, studiously ignoring the, you know, the enormous breadth of my bookshelf that Newsgard's books take up. It does seem that like a lot of autofiction, a lot of modern autofiction is written by women. And also, this seems to be somehow linked to the fact that, you know, what something that we're talking about here, the essay, and particularly the personal essay, is something to which, you know, writing a personal essay is something it seems like the burden has fallen upon, particularly young women over the last few years, especially online. And I wonder if those two things are connected. What do modern readers, perhaps some of those people on Goodreads, have against autofiction?
Well, they think that it takes no effort. And I think it's like the only literary novel that manages to, the only kind of literary novel that manages to sort of grab headlines over and over. And it's obvious why that is, because people can read anything that happens in a work of autofiction as true. So the reason why people connect so strongly to Knausgård's books is that it feels as if they're real and he really sort of goes there, right? And I think a lot of the lesser works of autofiction, which I don't really talk about in the essay, but a lot of the sort of standard works of autofiction you think of as having, as I think Joyce Carol has said in that tweet, you know, a lot of space between the paragraphs. So it seems like they're longer. And I think that there is a way that you might just write whatever happens in your life without sort of structuring it, without thinking about the style of the writing, without sort of thinking about how does the entire book fit together? And it's a quite an easy way to write a book if you were to just write like about your vague sense of alienation as you go to the grocery store and work on your computer and look at Twitter, right? There are certainly books of autofiction that do more or less just that. But there's also, I think, really wonderful novels that sort of get at something about contemporary life that kind of autobiographical fiction, say, does not really get at. And that is the role of the self and the public persona in contemporary life, which is to say that the autofictional author is understood to be the model for the narrator of the autofictional novel. And the reader understands that that narrator is related to the person whose name is on the cover of the book, right? So there's a real world person that corresponds to that narrator. And it's very similar to how social media functions. Also very similar, I'd say briefly, to how reality TV functions and used to function. So the way that we perform in our daily lives is kind of manifested by the autofictional narrator. And I think that that is why it's so popular, even though so many people also sort of reflexively hate it as a concept, because they think it's much harder to make things up than it is to just write down what happened. And that's not true. Now, I do think that people should lead more interesting lives. And I always advocate for sort of more drama in any book. So, you know, I'm not saying all autofiction is great. I'm certainly not saying that, but I am saying that, you know, it's not autofiction's fault. Some examples are sort of self-aggrandizing and pointless, right?
So I've been talking to Lauren Euler. We've been talking about her new collection of essays, No Judgment on Being Critical, which is out now in the UK from Virago. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.